What we're going to talk about today is the environmental effects of war. So if you want Japan, it's next door. Today I only have three transparencies. This week, as the days go past, I've had fewer and fewer. The ones who endured me on Monday saw about 180, and I kind of limited my number a little bit here. Also, since most of my comments are going to be directed at the Gulf War, there aren't a lot of numbers out yet. I'll use a few numbers in my talk, but that kind of data that scientists really like is only now being collected, and a heck of a lot of it has not yet been released, particularly by the U.S. government. I'll come back to that a little bit later on, but the U.S. government has really kind of put the lid on the data that has been collected in both Saudi Arabia and Kuwait so far. If you remember back before the Gulf War and during the Gulf War, our greatest fears seemed to revolve around chemical warfare, biological warfare, and the big nuclear unknown. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about each of those. And then I want to spend some time talking about some of the effects or some of the results of the war. I had a hard time deciding what word to choose here because environmental effects definitely sounded a little bit soft. You know, maybe environmental tragedies would have been a better choice of words. Please feel free to interrupt me at any time you want to put in your two bits or ask a question or whatever. But I want to spend a couple of minutes on unexploded ordnance. What's happened with water, because of course we're dealing with a war in a desert and a war that was along the banks of the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, damage to the desert, and then of course the thing that's on everybody's mind right now, the oil spills and the burning oil fields. I put those last, these two last, because while they're probably among the greatest tragedies of the war, these other issues are ones that haven't had much discussion yet and are really critical to the environment of the Middle East. Greenpeace has actually put out a report on the war, and so far it's the best report that's come out. And any of you who are really interested in that kind of thing might want to get a hold of Greenpeace when you get home and ask for their report on the Gulf War. It's been quoted very widely in the scientific press and is held up as being pretty accurate and basically the best source there is so far. What the Greenpeace report says is that the Persian, quote, the Persian Gulf War was not an orderly, flawlessly fought battle. Rather, it was unprecedented in the amount of destruction inflicted in such a short period of time. The Pentagon has coined the term hyperwar to describe this war. Greenpeace, again, quote, unprecedented environmental ruin, the most efficient killing campaign ever executed by any military force, one of the largest movements of civilians in the shortest period of time, the worst oil fires in history, and the biggest oil spill in history. The U.S. interim interagency report that has come out, it came out in May, says, quote, it may represent one of the most extraordinary man-made environmental disasters in recorded history. There are a variety of fears, like I said, that didn't materialize very fortunately, and one of these was chemical warfare. Very shortly after the war started, one of the PLU faculty members who was in Israel at the beginning of the war returned. He was in Israel because his family lives in Israel, and he wanted to be sure that his mother was okay. He's an Israeli citizen. So he flew to Israel just before the war started. It was real easy to get a plane ticket over. He was a little concerned about getting back, but he did succeed in getting back. But he brought his gas mask back with him. And when we had our forum at PLU on the war, you know, he had his gas mask right there beside him, just like he did at all points in time while he was in Israel. And he talked a little bit about, you know, the drills of putting the gas mask on, etc. With each Scud attack, they were, of course, afraid of chemical warfare. Now, there's a long history of chemical warfare in the world, dating back to the biblical mentions of salt being put on soil during war to prevent crop growth. But modern chemical warfare basically started with World War I. At the very beginning of World War I, tear gas, chlorine, and phosgene were used. Chlorine gets the lungs right away, smells awful, you know you're being exposed. By comparison, phosgene is somewhat slower acting, and it smells like new mown hay. By 1916, chemical weapons, including artillery shells and mortars, were used, and very shortly after that, mustard gas began to be used. Mustard gas doesn't smell like much at all. It was called Kampfstoff by the Germans. And for any chemists in the room, it's dichloroethyl sulfide. It's an oily liquid, heavier than air, so it tends to sink. It has delayed effects. It doesn't act immediately. It takes 1 to 12 hours before it has any real effects at all. And those, if it's ingested, those effects include nausea and vomiting. It will cause permanent eye damage. And of course, the biggest risk to troops was damage to the lungs, where people who were gassed may have had lifetime effects if they survived, but a good share of them who didn't die immediately ultimately had pulmonary edema and pneumonia and died from the pneumonia. It tended to seep into boots and uniforms and through the seams in uniforms and cause severe burns whenever it came in contact with the skin. Later in the war, as troops had gas masks, they began to put a non-lethal gas into the mixture along with the lethal gas, like mustard gas, and the non-lethal gas would be something that would pass through the cartridges and would cause nausea and vomiting, so troops would pull their masks off and then the lethal gas would get them. There were over 50 different kinds of chemical warfare agents used during World War I. Well, needless to say, it was considered pretty horrendous. So in 1925, the Geneva Convention was agreed to, and the Geneva Convention prohibited the use of, quote, asphyxiating, poisonous, and other gases. Now, it prohibited the use. It didn't say anything about development, production, possession, transfer to other countries, nor provide any mechanism of enforcement whatsoever. It was subscribed to by 130 countries, including the US, the USSR, and Iraq. In the late 1930s, of course, Italy used chemical warfare agents in Ethiopia. In World War II, chemical warfare agents, of course, weren't used on direct troops fighting each other very much. But, of course, during World War II, the Germans used chemical warfare agents on Jewish people and others who they killed. But in addition, they developed the first two nerve gas agents, Tabin and sarin. Those two nerve gas agents act in a very similar way to what parathion and malathion do, which are, of course, used as pesticides, but act at even lower concentrations. So those were nerve gases that were developed during World War II. Japan did use chemical warfare agents in China and did use chemical warfare agents on some American troops, on American prisoners of war, Allied prisoners of war, to try them out. The Vietnam War, of course, we used a couple of chemical warfare agents that you may not necessarily think of as such, but we used herbicides, Agent Orange, as well as napalm, both considered chemical warfare agents by the broader international community. In the discussions that are going on right now on an international convention on chemical warfare agents, the U.S. is objecting to herbicides being included, and they're also objecting to tear gas being included. Many other countries around the world would like both of those agents included as chemical warfare agents. Of course, Iraq used chemical warfare agents during the 1980s in two major incidences. In the Iran-Iraq war, Iraq used large quantities of mustard gas on Iranian troops. The U.S. didn't object at all to that, nor did the U.S. object to chemical warfare agents being used on the Kurdish people. Let me read you a quote from Saddam Hussein that he made on March 25th, 1990. And this was in a quote, fiery speech he was making to his armed forces. Quote, I swear to God, we will let our fire eat half of Israel if it tries to wage anything against Iraq. We don't need an atomic bomb because we have binary chemicals. Needless to say, that left Israel a little bit distressed. Binary chemicals are the latest generation of chemical warfare agents, where you take two components that are relatively non-toxic by themselves, but when you mix them together, they immediately react and make something very toxic. Very often, they are as well nerve gases. That means it's a lot easier to transport the shells around, a lot easier to work with them, because you don't have to worry about gassing people when you're loading shells, loading munitions, etc. By the way, the U.S. started manufacture and production of binary weapons in 1987. Let's go post-war for a second here. U.S. inspection teams, of course, have been going to Iraq since the war. A total of six teams have been there so far. Four have been looking for nuclear capabilities, one for chemical warfare capabilities, and one for biological weapons. The chemical warfare folks got back in mid-July, and Iraq was supposed to report what they found. And Iraq reported that they did have a chemical warfare factory at Samarra, which is northwest of Baghdad. And when the observation folks got there, they found that they found approximately four times what Iraq said that they had there. So Iraq had said that they had about 11,000 individual types of munitions there, and the UN people found 46,000 individual weapons there. And Iraq said that they had 650 tons of bulk chemicals that were either binary or were nerve gases or mustard gas or tear gas, and they found about 3,000 tons. They haven't identified what all this stuff is yet. They have found quite a bit of sarin, which is the nerve gas that I mentioned that the Germans developed. They also found warheads that would work on Scuds that had sarin in them. The team's going to return in September with sampling equipment to be able to sample some of these munitions. Any comments on chemical warfare? That's about all I'm going to say about it right now.
Were they just left there?
Well, this is where they were made, yeah.
So they're still right there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a small team of people who went, and they really didn't have the capabilities to take the stuff away. It's part of the reason they're going back in September, better equipped. But, yeah, I mean, you think about 3,000 tons of bulk chemicals, that's a lot of stuff. Um, psychological warfare, I'm not going to say nearly as much about, biological warfare agents can be bacteria, viruses, etc., that are isolated and put in vials or put in warheads. The biological warfare team just got back, and the preliminary report that I read in the New York Times said that they found large capabilities for biological warfare production, but they found hardly any biological warfare agents in Iraq. The two biological warfare agents that people were most concerned about were the bug that causes anthrax, because it gets into populations of cows, etc., and can be transmitted to humans. Anthrax is also very long-lasting in soil. So after anthrax gets in soil, you have to be concerned about it for a long time. It produces an endotoxin, which causes pulmonary damage, pneumonia, and fatal septicemia. Tularemia was another one that was of concern. It's transmitted by rabbits, but it would mainly be affecting people who would consume rabbits. But there's thought that the Iraqis have used tularemia on the Kurdish people, because of course the Kurds, and particularly the refugee Kurds, eat a lot of wildlife. Nuclear capability. There are a lot of unknowns here. A lot of what's been found has, by the UN, hasn't been released. Saddam Hussein certainly tried to increase nuclear capability during the 1980s. You may all remember that in 1981, the Israelis sent in a hit squad that blew up the French reactor, French-designed reactor. And after that war, it's estimated that Iraq salvaged about 12 kilograms of 93% uranium-235. They also produced some number of kilograms of uranium-235 from a Russian-designed reactor that they had. U.S. Customs had a sting operation in March of 1990, where they caught three employees of the Iraqi Military Research Institute who are trying to buy three capacitors that are used as the triggering device for nuclear warheads. The kind of bomb that they could build with this quantity of uranium would be something similar to the bomb used in Japan, the uranium bomb used in Japan during World War II, which would be an implosion bomb with somewhere between 7,500 and 15,000 equivalent tons of TNT. I guess this is certainly a very big unknown, and the Iraqis could have made a tremendous mess with this, but given what we've found so far, it sounds like the chemical warfare capabilities were quite a bit more serious than the nuclear warfare capabilities. And that kind of makes sense, because a lot of the chemical warfare agents are pretty easy to make. They're things that a standard chemist could just sit down and brew up, with standard industrial chemicals, as compared to having to have uranium or plutonium down here. Okay, those kind of cover our fears. And, you know, why they didn't make use of chemical and biological warfare agents, who knows? I certainly don't. But they didn't. They did do a lot of other stuff that was pretty bad. And I'd like to move on to some of these environmental effects that we do know of. Early in the war, right after the war started, of course, the Allies did a lot of bombing. And in the first several days of the war, when they were doing blanket bombing, it was about 10 times the rate of our bombing in Vietnam, and about 50% more intense than the Allied bombing of German cities during World War II, which kind of puts it in perspective. Lots of bombs. the U.S. used a lot of smart bombs, and many of these wait for hours or days before they explode, and many of them are triggered by metal nearby. 15 years after after the Vietnam War ended, there's a Mennonite hospital in Vietnam. I wish John Spooner isn't here, is he? He's going to ask me about this hospital. I didn't get a chance. There's a Mennonite hospital in Vietnam that's still getting between 15 and 20 new bomb injuries per week from unexploded ordnance in Vietnam. The U.S. also used a lot of anti-personnel cluster bombs. And these are about the size of a tennis ball. And what they do when someone gets near them, jars them, is they detonate and they're full of steel pellets. And there are lots of those spread all over. Also, of course, there are lots of bomb craters. Now, this war didn't go on nearly as long as the Vietnam War. But in Vietnam, it's estimated that there are 15 million, there were 13 million tons of bombs used, and there are 25 million craters in Vietnam. I can't comprehend how many 25 million craters are, but those are the craters still around. Of course, all these unexploded munitions in the Kuwaiti oil fields have been one of the things that have prevented cleanup around a lot of the wells, the oil wells. And of course, who knows how many unexploded munitions there are in Iraq. Very likely the U.S. government has made some estimates based on how many they know are duds or don't explode, but those estimates have not been released. So unexploded ordnance is certainly a big deal in both Saudi Arabia, to some extent, certainly in Kuwait, and definitely in Iraq. The water war. This war was fought largely in a desert, and water was in short supply. And you've all heard how they told U.S. troops to drink lots of water. Well, you might wonder where that water came from. Well, Saudi Arabia has 29 desalinization plants. The U.S. essentially appropriated the water from 28 of those during the course of the war. Most of those desalinization plants were pretty well protected from oil, so they're operating just fine, so they're still getting water from desalinization today. The other thing that the U.S. did was drill lots of wells. Saudi Arabia has an aquifer down at about 1,500 feet, and it depends on that aquifer quite heavily for drinking water. The U.S. sunk some unnamed number of wells down into that aquifer and extracted a lot of it during the course of the war. Well, the water had to go somewhere, and it's estimated that U.S. forces in the Gulf produce between 10 and 12 million gallons of sewage a day. And of course, when they were in the cities, they had some sewage facilities, but in the countryside, of course, there were very limited sewage facilities. There are sanitation engineers, of course, who accompany the troops. And it's estimated that the U.S. produced about 700 tons of garbage a day, and there's no indication that we brought any of that home with us. That was during the 43-day war, and of course, our garbage production has continued since then. Water can also be used as a weapon. We definitely destroyed water systems in Kuwait. We also destroyed wastewater systems, sewage treatment plants in Kuwait and Iraq. We destroyed water systems in Iraq as well. And it's part of the reason that there's quite a bit of disease in Iraq, because there's not a good water supply for most of the major cities today. We also bombed dikes and dams, and it's not clear how much damage that'll do to Iraqi farmland in the long run, how many dikes and dams they'll have to rebuild. It was fortunate this war didn't go on a whole lot longer, because there was a lot of concern about what might happen in the delta of the Tigris and the Euphrates. The delta has tall reeds in it. People say they're from 12 to 20 feet tall. And much like Vietnam, it's very likely Iraqi soldiers would have moved into those reeds. The U.S. response, of course, would have been to use herbicide, just like we did in Vietnam, to eliminate the reeds, which, of course, in the long run would have caused substantial erosion in the Tigris and Euphrates. There's no indication that we did use herbicide. Damage to the desert.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Any ideas about what's going to happen to the aquifer underneath the plate because of the oil spill and the sewage? Can anybody even think about that?
You know, I have no idea what the aquatired or impermeable layers are like in Kuwait, and likewise in Saudi Arabia. And I don't know, but that'd be a real excellent question for a geologist who spent some time working out there. And certainly there have to be a lot of petroleum geologists who know a heck of a lot about all those aquifers, because of course every time they're sinking an oil well, they're going to have an oil well log that's going to tell them exactly what the groundwater, or what the hydrology is like and what the soil types are like. But no, that's an excellent question. Deserts are very fragile environments. The Saudi desert is very varied. There are areas with dunes. There are areas that are hard and gravelly and flat. And the hard, gravelly, flat areas generally have a hard crust that forms on the surface, and the plants come up through that hard crust. So with that hard crust there, the ground is pretty stable, even though it's not getting much rainfall. One thing that war does, of course, is drive lots of vehicles over the desert in all kinds of different directions, and basically break through that crust. We know what happened in North Africa during World War II. 1941, the 7th Armored Division, the Axis, drove across Libya, and there was dust 18 inches thick within just a matter of days. And the dust storms were so bad that all military movement stopped for 3 days entirely. Everybody just sat there and waited for the dust to go away. There's one biologist who's done a lot of work in Saudi Arabia who's been quoted pretty widely, because he was a young man in Libya during World War II. And he said he left his tent to go to his friend's tent that was 3 feet away, and he couldn't find it, but fortunately he had a string, so he found his way back to his tent and just continued to sit there. 50 years later, if you go to the Libyan desert where they had those dust storms, it's about 30% recovered. 70% is not recovered, and the scars are still very apparent all over the desert. So it's very likely that the same kind of thing will occur in Saudi Arabia, that those scars are going to be there for a long period of time. Unfortunately, this crust is very important in holding water in, so there tend to be more water evaporation out while that crust begins to reform. It'll take a very long time for vegetation to come back in. That means that it's going to reinforce dry spells because the water won't be held in. And dust storms, if they occur, will tend to disrupt rainfall. Okay, the two biggies. Oil spills in the burning oil fields. Immediately before this war, the United Nations did a major study on the Persian Gulf, because they wanted to find out what the results of the 8-year Iraq war were on the Gulf. And it was the United Nations Environmental Program that did the study. And the report said, quote, The Persian Gulf is 43 times more polluted than any equal area in the world. There were 247 ships damaged when they started firing on each other's ships to try and block oil shipments. And there are 17 major shipwrecks in shallow water in the Persian Gulf that are left over from that war. Those are all tankers. Of course, the biggie during that war was the oil spill from Iran's Nowruz oil platform because Iraq sent a team out, which bombed the Nowruz oil platform. And that spill was about twice as big as the Exxon Valdez from that oil platform.